Welcome to the Inner Side Radio program, produced at Pacifica Radio in Houston. My name is Scooter. And I guess everybody with a TV in America has been following these assassinations of law enforcement officials in Texas and Colorado. This is not breaking news, but it's new to me. I've never seen anything like this. The white supremacist prison infrastructure is at war with a white supremacist prison gang, which usually goes on behind closed doors, but this one has spilled out onto Front Street. I'm just going to take a wild guess who's going to win this one. My money is on the white supremacists. Did you know that the world's favorite vacation paradise, North Korea, has a Twitter account and a Flickr page? Imagine the surprise of the millions of adoring followers this afternoon when they read, "Anonymous! Anonymous Korea! We are not terrorists. Don't fear us. We are good guys from the internet. Anon Korea, here to set you free." Yeah, they got hacked. Another twit was, "Tango down," with a link to the Flickr page and a photo of the glorious leader with a pig snout and floppy ears and a Mickey Mouse t-shirt, among other hilarious defacings. What do you expect, North Korea? Waving your alleged nuke around at everybody? You guys suck. I mean, you're an embarrassment to communism. Speaking of Tango Down, I guess you heard that our fellow outspoken secular humanist and film reviewer Roger Ebert got the big thumbs down today. I don't know if y'all followed his Chicago Sun blog exploits, but that guy was a lot more fun after his film show. He didn't pull any punches. So, Roger Ebert, you stomped the earth and left deep footprints. So, great 70-year run, and you'll be missed. And we take them out and show
ourselves when everyone has gone. Ever know what someone was going to say before they even said it? Hey, maybe a psychic. I'm Al Cassino, and today on All Things Long Island, we're joined by Teresa Caputo, star of the TLC show Long Island Medium. Thanks for joining us.
The pleasure is mine.
So, Teresa, can you tell us when you discovered your psychic abilities?
I first realized my psychedelic powers in 2010 when I predicted that I would, in fact, have chicken parm for dinner. And I did.
Impressive.
Yes. I just get these hunches, you know? For example, pick a number between 1 and 10 and visualize it in your brain noodle. Do you have that number?
I do.
What is that number?
6.
That's exactly what I thought it was.
Powerful stuff, Teresa. And now you have your own TV series in which you approach strangers in the grocery store, tell them intimate details about their lives, and relay messages from their dead relatives until they cry.
That is correct. Al, I have just written the answer to a question that has not been asked yet on this piece of paper. I'm giving it to you for safekeeping. I'll tell you when the time is right to open it.
You got it. We're going to the phone lines now. Lance from Massapequa Park. You're on with the Long Island Medium.
Hey, Teresa, I'm a big fan.
Okay, Lance, you recently celebrated a birthday in the last year. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Now, Lance, you had a great-great-great-grandfather. Am I on the right track here?
Yeah, you are.
And he is, unfortunately, no longer with us.
No. No, he's not.
He has a message he wants me to give you, Lance. You know that thing that you have been worried about?
Yeah.
Don't be. I think you know what that means.
Thank you. Thank you. That's what I needed to hear. You know, it's been a rough time lately. Been doing stuff and things I shouldn't be doing and thinking about and other stuff. And things, you know what I'm saying? And now I don't have to kill myself.
Thank you, Lance from Massapequa Park. Next caller, Dennis from Long Beach. You're talking to the Long Island Medium.
Hi, Teresa. I'm calling because I was recently diagnosed with inoperable brain cancer and a rare form of malaria.
I know.
But how did you...
It's a gift. Now, Dennis, at some point in your life, You lost someone.
When I was in fifth grade, my golden retriever was hit by a Chevy.
His name began with the letter of the alphabet?
It did. W for waffles.
He is here with me right now, Dennis. He wants me to tell you. Your inoperable brain cancer and that other thingy? Don't worry about it. I think you know what that means. Your kids are gonna be just fine.
I don't have kids.
No?
No.
Al, open that piece of paper. What does it say?
It says no. Oh my God.
Oh my God!
I rest my case.
There it is, folks. That's all the time we have this week. Join us next week on All Things Long Island when we discuss the subtleties between the Cheesecake Factory in Ronkonkoma and the Cheesecake Factory in Jericho.
You're listening to the Final Edition Radio Hour.
In the wake of his momentous washing of two women's feet on Holy Thursday, Pope Francis I further stunned traditionalist Catholics yesterday by taking another even more controversial step. The Pope's chief of staff and fellow Jesuit, Don Diego Sinistra, made the announcement at a press conference today in Rome.
When he visits Brazil in July, the Holy Papa is going to marry a transgender Brazilian guy named Juan.
Father Sinistra, how long has the Pope been dating Juan?
He hasn't. The Pope thinks Brazilians are beautiful people and he wants to unite the two biggest South American nations. So my Jesuit team found Juan last week on the popular Brazilian dating site BrazilCupid.com. We emailed with him and found him to be papabile, pope-worthy.
What will people call the happy couple?
Very simple. Mr. Francesco and Mrs. Juan Pope.
How does Juan feel about the marriage?
Oh, he's very pleased. He says it has always been his dream to marry a pope. He has only made one request, which the Pope has agreed to. In formal public appearances, they wear matching hats. Juan particularly likes the traditional papal tiara.
Appearing on the Today Show, hardline conservative Cardinal Timothy Dolan of New York surprised some by welcoming the new pontiff's radical move.
Look, this says to these same-sex homosexual Catholics, especially in his native Argentina, where unfortunately same-sex marriage is legal, that he gets it.
He gets it?
Yeah, he really gets it.
Gets what?
At the same time, he's telling straight lay people that a married clergy is okay, at least for popes. Plus, he won't be bucking us guys in the Catholic hierarchy.
He won't? Isn't this a total reversal of its opposition to same-sex marriage?
Uh-uh. In the eyes of God, Juan is still a woman.
Not all the reaction was positive, however. Cardinal Andreas Salt is head of the Vatican's powerful but little-known Office for the Prevention of Progress.
Like other unreliable popes whose reigns ended abruptly, for example, John 23rd and John Paul I, Francis I may have to be cielified. This word comes from the Italian cielo, or heaven. It means when a certain party is transitioned prematurely to the next life. Happily, cielification is frequently the first step toward sainthood.
Do you like bacon?
Sure, sometimes.
Then
but
come on and get your big, beefy bacon burger at Burger Busters. You get bacon, cheese, more bacon, a big, beefy burger containing bacon, cheese again, and two big bacon buns. Then you wash it down with bacon cola and a side of fried cheese with bacon.
Do you have anything vegetarian?
Sure, we have Thai salad with papaya and lime juice and bacon! It comes with a side of bacon orange juice and a bacon blueberry smoothie and bacon ice cubes and bacon Canadian bacon!
What if I don't want bacon?
Too bad! By order of the U.S. Congress, all food must now contain bacon!
What?
That's right! They couldn't pass filibuster reform, but they passed this!
This is a nightmare!
So come on down to Burger Busters for your federally mandated diet of bacon! Eat the goddamn bacon!
I'm Stone Peck. Welcome to Lost Causes. Tonight we talk about gun control and why we can't get it. The NRA says guns should be taken out of the hands of criminals and put in the hands of law-abiding citizens. Joining me tonight is a special panel of experts.
I'm Howard, and I'm an armed robber.
I'm Faith, and I'm an accessory to murder.
I'm Sammy, and I'm what you'd call a hitman.
Good to have you with us. Howard. You use guns in your line of work, right?
Oh, well, I wouldn't be much of an armed robber without arms, would I?
But do you really have to use a gun?
Well, I can't pull a bank job with a Swiss Army knife. I mean, I can, but by the time I get past the can opener, the screwdriver, a wire stripper, a key ring and tweezers, they've called the police and I'm looking at 20 years in jail.
So you need some kind of firearm.
Yeah. Something to wave around, shoot in the air, point at people, that kind of thing.
Faith, you also work with arms.
Not directly. As an accessory, I work with the people who work with guns.
So, okay, in any given murder, you don't do the actual killing?
No. I know about the killing, but the trigger pulling is done by the murderer.
So you're not actually a criminal, but a friend of the criminal.
Oh no, I'm a criminal. Accessory isn't glamorous, but it is illegal.
Okay, so as a lawbreaker yourself, you object to the NRA's demonization of murderers.
Stone, murderers tend to murder one, maybe two people at a time. Not like these law-abiding citizens with their Bushmaster 223 semi-automatic rifles who can kill large numbers of people almost instantly.
Who needs to kill that many? It's outrageous.
Sammy the Hitman, you're saying that even a contract killer can't believe the huge amount of firepower available to the public?
Yo, why should I have to enter witness protection for killing fewer people in 20 years than one nut job does in 5 minutes?
We formed our own organization to fight the NRA, the NCA.
The National Criminal Association.
Not to be confused with the NCAA.
Although what they do can be criminal, too.
Yeah.
We want assault weapons taken out of the hands of law-abiding citizens and put back in the hands of criminals who know how to use them.
So you're saying that law-abiding citizens don't commit crimes, criminals do.
Exactly.
And that's a good thing.
No, it's a fucked up thing.
We're saying leave the crimes to us, okay?
Yeah, when we commit a crime, it makes sense. Like this. Stone, give me your wallet and your watch and you won't get hurt.
I see what you're saying. That's all the time we have.
No, Stone, give me your wallet and your watch.
Is this an armed robbery?
Yes.
But you don't have a gun.
I told you, you left it in the car.
Wait. I got a Swiss Army knife. A corkscrew, can opener.
This'll take him some time.
Blade,
for the final edition, I'm Stone
can
Peck.
Can opener, screwdriver, wire stripper, key ring, tweezers.
That was from the final edition radio hour. Produced by Tony Handra and Jeff Chrysler. Engineered by Greg Russ. Check out the entire program from their website at thefinaledition.com. Now we're going to hear part two of my conversation with Dylan Brody, recorded just before the Eastover holiday, followed by a cut from his new CD, Writ Large.
Much of my work involves giving the audience all the pieces they need at the beginning, so that they can feel up to speed with me by the end and can make the connections for themselves that they need to grasp what I've said. I don't moralize very much on stage. I used to, when I was a political comic, it was all about, I hate this guy and this is what he's done, and I love this guy because this is what he's done, and whatever it is, here are the jokes that follow. And when I was doing political comedy frequently, I would start by saying, so have you heard about Proposition 187? And then I would sort of give the quick rundown on what Prop 187 was, using jokes to tell that, to give that, those pieces of information, and then get down to the business of dissecting whatever my thoughts are on it through jokes. Right, so through those first jokes, I've set everybody up with the information they need to feel well-informed on it, and now I'm taking them through the laughter about, you know, tearing down the Statue of Liberty and putting up the statue of the old grumpy guy who universally represents no vacancy. And with the stories, there's very much the same thing. I'm giving pieces of experience that they need up front to understand later what my take is on something that has happened more recently, or a sense of me and how my mind works that will allow them to be making the connections that I'm making by the end of the piece. Because it is always my goal to allow the audience to rise to the level of its greatest intellect.
Well, you must recently find yourself in this recent age of the Louis Gohmert and the Michelle Bachmann and the Sarah Palin going, oh, I sure miss political comedy.
There are moments when I do, and frequently when I'm doing a club date, if I've got a couple of political jokes, I'll throw them out at the beginning just as sort of offhanded thoughts before I get to what I'm going to do. But more than that, Twitter and Facebook give me an outlet
right
for all of those snarky comments that years ago would have turned into a new tag or a new tap line in a long piece. I used to, you know, constantly come up with a new joke to throw in. It was how I built my set over time. And now I just throw them out there on Twitter. I throw them out there on Facebook, and I get the joke out into the world. I don't feel unsatisfied because I've got this important moment of hilarity that I can't share with anyone. And it doesn't need to invade all of my stage time and clearly alienate 48% of the audience that might be listening.
Right. It's not unlike doing radio in a way, you know. It's broadcasting.
Yeah. Exactly. On Facebook, sometimes there's conversation and there are trolls and there's debate on something, and that's
hecklers,
fine.
Hecklers, yeah.
yeah, exactly. They're hecklers.
Yeah. But I when something important is happening on the, like the president's given the Kilda Osama speech and so forth, I'll run over to Facebook and turn it on, because I some of my Facebook friends are like David Feldman and Barry Crimmins and, you know, all these guys that do, and Jimmy Dore, and all these people who do political comedy. We just kind of race into the jokes, you know.
Absolutely.
It's fun to watch, yeah. Live blogging, I think they call it in a way. So.
Yeah, I sometimes will live tweet through Witstream, and I certainly live tweet a lot of political events. I don't always remember to. I am not young enough for social media to be instinctive to me yet. I know younger comics who it's automatic. They got, as soon as something starts happening, they've got their phone out and they're tweeting. I actually have to sit down at my computer and turn something on.
Yeah, me too.
To remember that I should tweet.
And there's also a certain age of or maturity or jadedness that you get in politics, where it's, you know, it's the old Who song, "We Don't Get Fooled Again." It's just, I mean, it, when you're going for the hope and the change, and you're going, "Oh, it's Wall Street."
Exactly. Yeah, I find myself really torn because I am not a lockstep kind of guy. And there is so much that I like about Obama. And even during the election, I kept saying, remember...
In 1984, on Halloween evening, I went to hear Susan Sontag speak, although I didn't want to. I like to do a show in which the audience feels they have to apologize when they laugh. That's... My goal is to make rooms full of people so uncomfortable that even applause feels like a breach of trust. My roommate asked if I had plans, and I told her I was going to hear Susan Sontag at NYU. She said, "Why didn't you tell me? That sounds really cool." And then she said, "I wish I could go. I was going to invite you to this stupid costume party I have to go to for work." Had Emily not said that it sounded really cool, I would have abandoned the plan instantly to go with her to a costume party. I would have abandoned any plan to go with her to a costume. I would have abandoned any plan to go with her anywhere. But she had said that the lecture sounded really cool, and I didn't want her to think me the kind of man who would forsake a really cool academic lecture to attend a costume party that she deemed stupid. I couldn't stand to be that man in her eyes. Emily had that sort of thick, curly hair that makes men want to drive their fingers deep into it and that inexplicably makes women want to get it straightened. Emily frequently cursed and complained while she brushed it out, but she refused to cut it short. She had always loved it, she told me. And when she lost her right arm, everyone from family to physical therapists... told her in casual, matter-of-fact tones that she would obviously have to cut her hair now. She refused because she had always loved her hair and she didn't want one traumatic injury to entirely redefine her. She leaned against her bedroom doorway and cupped the stump of her right arm in her left hand. It was her version of crossing her arms, and while it may have felt like a way of hiding the nub, it actually drew attention to it. The remnant of her right arm was a constant source of fascination for me, though I tried not to allow that to be obvious. She had, over the previous few years, grown reluctantly accustomed to stares, and I certainly didn't want her to feel like a spectacle when she was in her own home, when she was around me. Still, I was always aware. Sometimes, when she had had a little too much wine or much too little sleep, she would glance at something and her stump would twitch before she reached for the object with her left hand. For the barest instant, a look of surprise and then sheepishness would cross her face. Then that would be masked by her deep dimpled smile. An almost identical dimple appeared at the end of her little arm when certain muscles flexed. I noticed. So instead of going to a costume party dressed as a swashbuckler with my beautiful one-armed maiden at my side, I dressed in an academic tweed jacket with suede patches on the elbows and took a subway to the Village. I stopped at a favorite comic book store to look over the latest releases and then walked through the gleeful streets of Greenwich Village on Halloween toward the lecture hall. I emerged from the store into the crosstown wind, stepping directly into the path of a pedestrian. Sexy Bo Peep, cross-dressed for the holiday in heels and white thigh highs with powder blue bow ribbon garters, apologized for bumping me. I apologized in return. She was tall, several years older than I in my 20th year. She was shaved so close and made up so exquisitely that a young man might be fooled for a moment, or a minute, for an hour, a few drinks, if he were inclined to allow himself. I felt the confusing ambivalence of attraction and mild homophobia. The figure from fairy tale fetish fantasy made eye contact and smiled, seeing the confusion in my eyes, a flash of young lust combined with the slight involuntary retreat of my pelvis as I realized her true gender. She saw it all and was not offended. She nodded just a little, almost coyly, and suddenly, inexplicably, I felt very, very close to her, warmed, accepted. I wanted to tell her that I wished I could be so brave, just dress up to expose my desires, that I could walk the world even for one day out of the year as myself and let others react as they would. I wanted to say, I am in love with my roommate, but I cannot tell her. I want to hold her and comfort her, to feel strong and protective. There was so much in my mind, feelings cascaded, shame that I could find pleasure in the source of Emily's pain, self-loathing that I might be turned on by her trauma, rage at my feminist family for denying me any sense of manliness, guilt for my strength, my body, the wrongs committed by my gender as a whole, envy for the beautiful man who stood before me, his package surely tucked and taped to allow the illusion to remain for a time as the costume peeled away the disguise he wore to express his true identity. I returned the smile and said only, "Wow, you look good enough to confuse a straight man." He said, "Aren't you sweet?" and blew a kiss to me over his shoulder as he moved on down the street. That night, Susan Sontag spoke of the role of the artist in the work of the photographer. She said that photography is ultimately an art form of editing. A photograph seems to be a simple document of visual fact, but the photographer determines not only what is seen, but what is left outside the frame. Often, she said, the real beauty, the real revelation, lies in the mystery beyond the presentation, what is left unseen, what is cut off. She was fairly brilliant, and I was tremendously glad to have heard her speak, if not to have chosen her over the costume party with Emily. On the subway ride back uptown, I decided to reveal my love, but then something had happened at the party. I never found out exactly what it was. When I got home, she had already changed out of her costume and wore a long New York Knicks t-shirt that she used as a nightgown. She was sad, sniffling, her arm wrapped around her knees, a Flintstones juice glass of wine on the table beside her, half empty. She said she didn't want to talk about it. I didn't push it, though I did say that I wished I could have been there with her, which was true. I wished that whatever had happened, I had been there to protect her, to defend her, to win her heart with an act of chivalry and kindness. I wanted to move to her now, to wrap myself around her, to whisper warm reassurances into her ears. I recognized a moment I could turn into a seduction. But it felt as though that would be taking advantage of her in a time of weakness, and I could not bear to be that man in her eyes. So I sat with her and let her talk about the things she talked about and not whatever was really bothering her. Occasionally, she tugged at her short right sleeve, wrapping it around the end of her stump and then releasing it when she picked up the wine. When she sipped from the glass, it seemed to me to be half full. Her toes flexed and then gripped at the leading edge of the seat cushion. A week later, she told me that she hated the city, that she was moving back to Glen Falls. She apologized for leaving me such short notice to find a new roommate. And then she was gone. I dress up in carefully chosen, interesting cufflinks and use words to weave images together so tightly I can stand unseen behind them and seem to lay myself bare. I claim in radio interviews and cocktail party conversation that I tell these stories in the hope of freeing us all to dress as ourselves, to peel away our pretense until it seems that every one of us stands naked beneath a halogen street lamp, crying out the secret names of our most deeply dungeoned demons. That claim is a lie. When I reveal these secrets of mine, these shame-laden longings, these sighing, screaming, sleep-stealing loose threads of my frayed psyche, it is with one true motivation only. I peel off my disguise in the hope that one night, one of these desperate flares will light the sky at just the right angle, that it will create a moment of translucence. I stand behind these tapestries and hope that somehow, through the dense fabric of distracting imagery, my own shameful truth is implied clearly enough that it becomes perceptible, at the very least, as a phantom sensation. Thank you.
That was Phantom of Love, a cut from Dylan Brody's just-released CD, Writ Large, available on Amazon, iTunes, and all your favorite online download places. Our conversation was a lot of fun, and we only heard parts of it on the air, but if you Google The Inner Side, it will direct you to this program's audio website, where I'll publish it in its entirety. Give it a listen. Dylan tells some great stories, and there's some good banter in prime form. You'll find it at program number 390. Check out the irreverent skeptical atheist podcast, Skeptiles, at skeptiles.com with Joe Dixon, Sean Ewald, and myself. This has been the Inner Side Radio Program, and I'll see y'all next week.